listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really happy to have with me once again Christopher Martinson. Chris holds a PhD from Duke and an MBA from Cornell. He is an economic researcher and futurist specializing in energy and resource depletion, and he's the co-founder of peakprosperity.com along with Adam Taggart. Thanks for joining me again, Chris.
Oh, Jay, it's my pleasure to be back with you.
It's always good to have you. You know, before we get started, let me strongly suggest to my listeners that they bookmark Peak Market or peakprosperity.com. That's the right place, right? Peakprosperity.com?
Yep, that's it.
And you're very active there. You provide a blog. There's some audio-visual stuff there as well that's very valuable. Chris, I want to talk to you today about an article that I picked up from your website a couple of weeks ago regarding the importance of changes taking place in Saudi Arabia and how that may impact investors in the United States. You know, that was a November 10th article titled, "If the Saudi Arabia Situation Doesn't Worry You, You're Not Paying Attention," end of quotes. And you started out the article by saying, and I quote, "While turbulent during the best of times, gigantic waves of change are now sweeping across the Middle East. The magnitude is such that the impact on the global price of oil as well as world markets is likely to be enormous." Then you stated, and I quote, "A dramatic geopolitical realignment with Saudi Arabia is in full swing this month that is upending many decades of established order." So my question is, you know, of course, we have all heard of the house arrests that are taking place. I think, well, I don't know if we all have, but it's been in the news. The princes in Saudi Arabia from the old guard. What can you tell us about that event as well as how it fits into the greater geopolitical order in the Middle East and beyond?
Well, I wish I could do this in a single sentence. It's so complex that, of course, some context is really essential here. And anybody could be forgiven for not understanding Saudi politics. Even people who examine it very closely have a hard time keeping up because we're talking about a ruling family, a dynasty with that's been very prolific. There's 4,000 princes, at least 2,000 of them hold significant assets or power. And it's really a sort of a, you know, the Corleones mobsters meets Game of Thrones intrigue, you know, so it's really hard to get your arms around. But just understand there's a lot of money involved. There's a lot of ego involved. There are a lot of participants involved. And so there was a major realignment and shakeup. Now, this is normal. You get shakeups and things like this. But the person who came into charge, his son is Mohammed bin Sultan, and who we can shorten up to MBS, Mohammed bin Sultan. Mm-hmm. MBS is young, in his 30s, young 30s, and very, very aggressive in terms of how he wants to reshape the country. Now, a lot of what's being talked about in the U.S. press is very unfortunately focusing on, I think, the wrong angle, which is that he's trying to make his country more progressive and bring it out of the oil age into some new magic thing, which, I don't know, they'll manufacture, hopefully, sand into something. But the truth is that what actually happened was we have to rewind this story just a little bit and understand that 1973, Yom Kippur War, United States supported Israel. The Arab nations, of course, were very unhappy with all of that, got the oil embargo, a lot of upset about that. Well, in 1974, Saudi Arabia was thinking, well, geez, you know, we still like to sell our oil, and we'd really like to, we need help with security because they were still sort of a founding dynasty at that point in time. They had a lot of military needs, but they couldn't be seen coming to the United States to sell their oil, and we were their number one, by far, number one customer at that point in time. So anyway, backdoor deal gets struck for 40 years. The United States and Saudi Arabia hold secret that at that moment, Saudi Arabia had struck a deal to buy U.S. treasuries, and we were going to hold them for them in a special secret account. And no conspiracy. This is all public record now. Mm-hmm. So that all made sense, right? Saudi Arabia wanted to sell their oil, but they didn't want to be seen selling it to the United States. openly because it would be kind of politically embarrassing because of Israel, all that. So at any rate, that's all been happening for a long time, and that enshrined something I'm sure your listeners are familiar with called the petrodollar, with Saudi Arabia as the cornerstone of this idea, which is that if you want to trade in oil, you need dollars, which is great for the United States. We export dollars and people need them because they want to buy oil, and those dollars get recycled back into our capital markets, because the other part of that deal with Saudi Arabia was not just that they're going to sell oil to us, not just to us for dollars, not just that, but they're going to buy treasuries, but they're going to recycle other parts of their proceeds into the U.S. markets. That includes real estate, equities, the whole nine yards. So Saudi Arabia owns a big, giant chunk of the U.S., long-standing arrangement. It's been great. Well, I don't know, you know, your listeners will probably remember this too. It was in 2016, Congress was going to pass this crazy little law that was going to release a 28-page document that was going to finger a bunch of Saudi nationals, in particular government officials, as complicit with the whole 9/11 fiasco.
Right.
And that was going to open them up potentially to lawsuits by families. And of course, the United States has a long history of filing suits against other countries inside U.S. court systems, getting huge judgments and having the Treasury Department and State Department, you know, strong arm those results. So Saudi Arabia was upset at this. Obama had to fly over, and this is at the tail end. I think he's, you know, the election's already happened. It's somewhere around November or December. And so he flies over there to smooth everything over. Well, he must have done a bad job, because it was not March of that same year that Saudi Arabia goes and trundles over to Beijing, brings a huge entourage. I was talking with the former president of a major oil company, and he was there at the time, and he said, "You wouldn't believe it, Chris. They flew all these 747s in." Two numbers for you. They brought six fully armored Rolls Royces with them, and they brought 150 cooks just to feed everybody else who came, right? So they're doing this. And why are they doing this, Jay? Because they inked about $70 billion of deals during that meeting, which, as you know, or anybody knows, you don't just go over and ink $70 billion in deals. Those deals have already been negotiated. They were, this was sort of the inking, the signing part, but they'd already been decided beforehand. So that's move number one. Move number two, October of that same year of 2017, first time in history we have a giant entourage like that from Riyadh heading over and going to Moscow. So now we have Saudi Arabia and Russia getting together. Again, $70 billion of deals inked, and it was the breadth of those deals that really caught me. Technology, healthcare for nuclear reactors, and most impressively for the Russian S-400 anti-aircraft missile system, they're most advanced. Now, they're not going to sell that to just anybody. And, you know, Russia has been on the other side of Saudi Arabia in the whole Syrian conflict.
Sure.
Russia's also been supporting Iran, and Iran has the S-300 missile system. So all this stuff is happening, but two things come from this. One, the United States is no longer at the dance floor with Saudi Arabia. And two, they're inking military deals with China and with Russia, saying they've pivoted away from the United States. This is big, big, big news. It tells us that Saudi Arabia has read the future and has decided that its future doesn't lie with the United States at this point, that they need to begin making other friends in the world. And they've done that now with a total of over close to $200 billion of deals, because China came back for a second drink just a month ago and inked another $70 billion. So they're off to the races. You know, if they're dating, they've already decided to move in together. They're selecting furniture and sofas and carpets and things. Wow. So this is a big deal. This upends 45 years of oil diplomacy, and it's happening, and it's not being talked about in the U.S. press.
It's not being talked about, but I have to think, well, I want to ask you, to what extent do you think this agreement for Saudi Arabia to buy treasuries, to recycle their dollars into treasuries, and I think also OPEC was maybe required also to demand dollars for payments as a whole, and so, you know, I can see, Chris, how this would go beyond just United States and Saudi Arabia. If the whole world, if the exporting countries, oil countries, were demanding dollars instead of their own currency, some other currency, then let's say a country like Bolivia that has to import oil would need dollars. And you know, I mean, it would just be sort of like the whole, if they wanted to buy bananas from, well, let's say a northern European country wanted to buy bananas from Bolivia, they would have to get dollars to buy those bananas from Bolivia because Bolivia would need the dollars to buy their oil, right?
That's correct. So a number of things happen when you have the petrodollar. It
yes.
means that any importing nation needs to have dollars to buy
right.
those with. Right. Now, again, of course, capital markets are what they are. The oil exporters could, I don't know, take those dollars and sell them instantly for Bolivian currency and or if they wanted to. But
yeah.
but the truth is that since 2000 to about 2016, which is the last year I have data, about 7 trillion petrodollars were accumulated by oil exporters.
Mm.
And it's just an astonishing pile. So what would have happened if those oil exporters didn't have to accumulate 7 trillion excess U.S. dollars, what would have been different? Well, U.S. interest rates would have been a lot higher. All kinds of things would have
sure.
been very different. And so, you know, in this story, we have to ask, okay, well, if the petrodollar is dying, what's it being replaced with? Because you don't just send your oil cargo off for nothing. And that's where the second part of this story is interesting, where I'm sure your listeners have heard that
mm-hmm.
China opened an oil bourse where you can trade futures for oil denominated in yuan, their onshore
right.
currency, right? Plus, you know, nobody really actually wants to accumulate too many yuan more than you would need for trading because China has closed capital markets. You can't buy Chinese government bonds. You know, they have foreign direct investment, very constrained. So what do? Well, that's where China also joined that with the idea that you could take any yuan that you had and you could use them on the Shanghai Gold Exchange, buy gold, and they would allow that to leave the shore. So that's they opened the capital market, but for gold of all things, which feels like a little poke in the eye at the system, if you will. But that's where they decided to open their capital markets. And by all accounts, this is going really well. And this makes a lot of sense, but you have to understand where we really are in the oil story, and people in the United States really are very deluded because we just get this, it's literally propaganda about how amazing shale is and it's changed everything and it'll be changed forever. It's absolutely wrong. And
yeah, well,
it's a big story.
I want to explore that with you, Chris, because I know you've done an awful lot of work there on that. But so I wasn't aware that China has agreed then in these instances to allow gold to leave the Chinese shores.
Yes, that's how I understand it.
Oh, okay. Well, that's very important. You could understand why Saudi Arabia may be a bit hesitant to accept yuan right now. But if they could exchange them into gold, that's another story, of course. And it's very interesting because it seems to me the petrodollar really replaced gold in the sense that, you know, I've always wondered, how could the dollar retain its value when we went off the gold standard way back then? And I'm old enough to remember it. I'm older than you are. I remember it very well. Reading the New York Times the following day and just being amazed at how could the dollar retain any value if it had nothing behind it? Well, of course, it has had. It's had oil and it's had the U.S. military.
Mm-hmm.
Some people believe that that's been a very important part of the equation as well, to send a signal to the Saddam Husseins of this world, or the Gaddafis of this world, or anybody else that may decide they don't want dollars anymore. Do you buy that?
I do, and this is where the story gets really fascinating and also a little confusing for me, because there are elements inside the United States government, call it the shadow government, or maybe not even all that shadow, that are very keen to pick a fight with Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm confused by that because, you know, the United States has had a very, very powerful military as long as you were going up against Saddam, who was
sure.
hobbled by 2 decades of sanctions, or, you know, you're going to go beat up on a Libya or, you know, with no air force or whatever. That's one story. But it's a very different story when you pick a fight with somebody like Russia, who has a tiny military budget compared to ours, but they didn't pour their money into building aircraft carriers. They poured mm-hmm. their money into missile technology. And oh, mm-hmm. my goodness, their missile systems. If people haven't studied them, take a look. It's space age secondary. You know, for instance, just not to get too wonkish, but their Zircon missile system, these things are flying at Mach 5 or 6, unless they go exo-atmospheric, in which case they fly at Mach 8. They come in
wow.
a swarm, and of the swarm, one of them flies high, like about 130,000 feet, and coordinates all the other ones.
Huh.
And the rest of them are coming 5-6 feet off the deck, and the kinetic energy on these alone is enough to tear a ship in half, but they put a warhead on for good measure. If the one that's high up gets lost, another one will fly up and take its place. And there's literally no possible way to stop a swarm that comes in. And these things have what's called vectored thrust technology, meaning they don't steer with fins, which get torn off at those speeds. They steer with a nozzle. And so they can do crazy maneuvers at the end, pulling 50, 60 Gs if they need to, and fly crazy patterns. And all of our anti-missile missile technology is geared on, you know, you calculate a trajectory, you know where something's going to be, and you shoot something there. It's like skeet shooting. Well, skeet shooting gets a lot harder when the skeet can perform evasive maneuvers right at the end.
My goodness.
I have a hard time when they don't, you know. So this is the technology we're up against. And I go through all of this simply to say that if the United States goes up against a foe that has that technology, we're going to discover that ships, no matter how sophisticated they are metal boxes looking for a reason to sink. And the minute that happens, the very minute that happens, the entire calculus changes because the world suddenly discovers that power is now projected by people who can walk to places rather than people who have to float there. The United States has a wonderful advantage. We've got two giant long coastlines. It protects us. It's wonderful. It's also a flaw if you're trying to be a global military empire, and the only way you can get, you know, a battalion, an armored battalion from point A to point B is to put it on a ship. So I think that the calculus would change very, very rapidly. I believe it's part of the reason that Saudi Arabia did its pivot. This is speculation on my part, but remember, everything in Syria was kind of going one way until there was a day when Russia announced that they were bringing in the S-400 system, and they parked it right there in the center of Syria, and suddenly the entire dynamic changed because the United States and NATO couldn't fly over the country anymore. We did not want to go up against that missile system. So I think Saudi Arabia looked at that and said, oh my goodness, you brought in your missiles. It changed everything. It threw the war against us, and we lost that. But instead of sort of nursing those wounds, MBS pivoted very quickly and said, oh, calculus has now changed. And very shortly after, they were striking deals with two brand new partners. It's really big news. It really is.
It really is big news, Chris. And this is just another example of the kind of big news that we're not hearing as Americans. It's out there for people like you who dig, you know, with the internet and everything available. But most people aren't aware of this at all. And you have to think, you know, I mean, I was talking to Mr. Rickards in the past, and his view, at least a year or so ago, was that our military was still strong enough and that the only way these countries could really compete would be through currency wars, you know, to do what you just talked about they're doing with gold and their own currencies and their own trading infrastructure that they put together. But what I'm hearing from you is that that's not all they have. And certainly our military then is aware of that, right? I mean, our CIA better be, our Pentagon better be aware of that, what you're just telling us.
Yeah, I trust the Pentagon is aware of that. Of course, they're fantastic at what they do. But the people who are actually going to be the ones who would force the military to get into a conflict would be the neocons, who I think everybody who's paying attention understands, these are crazy individuals. They don't understand force moderation. They don't understand anything other than just projecting wild, overbearing force. And that's great if you're up against a heavily outmatched foe. But just to put this in context, look, still roughly 40% of the world's oil that's exported, which is all the stuff we care about, right? That still goes through the Strait of Hormuz, which is a 2-mile-wide gap over there in between the isthmus that separates Iran from the rest of those Arabian countries on the other side. These missile systems I just talked about, if they were operational, and by the way, they can fire from, the Zircon's interesting because it fires from any platform. It fires from anything that anybody has. It comes off of trucks, subs, planes, two different types of planes, maybe, you name it, doesn't matter. So if those were in place over there, and we have every reason to think they probably are, the entire Persian Gulf is off limits, right? You can't take the Seventh Fleet. It has to be, and by the way, these things have a range of around 400 to 500 kilometers. So you have to take this and move it really far away, you know, and that's even trusting that, you know, they're not going to put some on a speedboat and take it, you know, closer to you. So you probably have to go even further away. Once you're that far away, your planes don't count anymore. They can't run effective sorties. You know, you don't have, it's just everything, the whole calculus changes, but the entire Persian Gulf is now off limits to U.S. military ships and hardware. So, you know, it really changes the calculus very, very rapidly. And the concern here is that the neocons are just going to push until they get the war that they seem to want. And, you know, we're all unclear on what their actual aims are. Is it just, you know, grotesque self-interest because they have military contracts on the back door? Or is it something more ideological? We don't know. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But it's certainly, you know, to me, the frightening thing is to think how rapidly things will change geopolitically once the United States loses a few ships in some sort of a skirmish like this.
Chris, you know, you've been very much against the fracking that we've, for various reasons, and you've talked about it on this show in the past. Has that been a big negative then in terms of our relationship with Saudi Arabia? I would imagine, because it's my understanding that China is now Saudi Arabia's largest client. Is that right?
It's true. And China is now the world's largest importer of oil by far. The United States and China were neck and neck as recently as 3 years ago, but then we had our fracking revolution. So we went from, you know, close to 6 million, 7 million barrels a day down to about 3 or 4 million barrels a day now. But China's importing 8 million barrels a day. And the two countries that are sort of neck and neck to vying for who's going to be the largest supplier of oil to China are Russia and Saudi Arabia. So that's how we kind of understand the rest of this picture. And the most interesting thing in this story before we get over to fracking is that China released a report commissioned by the state, and it was run by what's called the Beijing Petroleum University. And so this is a state-funded university. All they study is petroleum. Mm-hmm. And the report came out just a few months ago, and it said, China's going to face a peak in oil output from both conventional and unconventional sources. They had a run at their own shale reserves, such as they were, and discovered that they were too geologically molested to be useful. The United States has world-class shale basins. We're not finding that they are replicated elsewhere in the world. And so China discovered, to their dismay, that theirs weren't useful. And they'll get some. They have a little smidge that they're expecting. So what it means is that their oil output is going to be falling and their oil imports are going to be climbing. And so this really translates into, roughly speaking, almost doubling of oil imports over the next 10 to 12 years. Now, little context, Jay, this means that by my calculations, China's going to be importing close to 30 to 40% of all available oil for export in the world. That's not going to happen. Who's not going to get oil at that point in time is the question we'd have to ask. And so, you know, now we have to say, well, if that's not going to happen, how does this resolve? Two ways: dramatic, very, very dramatic price spikes, or war.
Boy, it's not a very hopeful outlook there, Chris. I'm not so sure I'm happy to have you on the show, but we have to face reality. And this is what so what should we be doing now about it with just a few minutes left here? What is this going to mean? First of all, it seems to me that the dollar could be toast. We may be looking at a dollar are they going to hyperinflate this thing to try to make, you know, how's the government going to pay for all of the promises it's made to Americans, for example, old people, you know, what's going to happen?
Well, you know, we're at that stage of the story. Remember, this is why context is essential. This isn't like we just suddenly got to this point. What happened was we went off the gold standard in 1971, and it's just been an absolute ridiculous, you know, set of policy errors ever since that are founded on this really dumb idea that you could grow your debts at twice the rate of your income. That's the underlying problem here, right? Or predicament, I should say. And so when you ask the question about, you know, how do we pay all these underfunded or even unfunded pension liabilities for retirees, the answer is we won't. You can't pay them off in current dollar terms, because in the United States, in current dollar terms, when we add up all the IOUs and debts in one spot, so that's liabilities plus debts, the United States is standing at 1,100% debt and liabilities to GDP. 1,100%.
Nobody's incredible.
So the only question that I'm asking my subscribers and listeners to resolve is this: who's going to eat the losses? That's the question.
Yeah.
Right? So you know as well as I do, the Federal Reserve is going to try and inflate their way out of this, but they're looking at the wrong measures. They're looking at prices. Prices and inflation are separate things. Prices are the symptom. Inflation is when the monetary system starts heating up and you have more, you know, credit and credit instruments flooding through the system. That's the source. But, you know, if we get this oil price spike that I think is coming in 2 to 3 years, the Federal Reserve will count victory because prices are spiking. But those will be misery for the people involved, because that's actually going to be stagflation at that point, not the inflation that they were hoping for.
Right. And rates are rising now, as Alistair McLeod explained on the show recently. That, you know, gives the banks all kinds of reason to sell their treasuries and to put money into the system more. So we have already, I think, some concerns about rising price levels. And I don't know what your thoughts are, but it seems to me that with all this high-powered money still sitting in the Federal Reserve system, in the banking system since 2008, 2009, that there could be an awful lot of hurtful inflation heading our way in the not-too-distant future. I'm fearful of that. Do you share that concern?
Well, yes, and it's going to happen, I think, because we have to understand that derivatives, currency, stocks, bonds, they're all just claims on actual wealth. And those claims have just gone through the roof when we look at how much, you know, currency and currency equivalents has been flooded and printed and pushed into the system. At the end of the day, none of those have any value to us unless we can buy something with it. For now, everybody's happy thinking, hey, I have increasing claims in a financial sense. But, you know, inflation happens, and hyperinflation particularly happens when people suddenly decide, oh, I don't actually want the claim on the thing. I need the thing, right?
Yep.
And so all that money starts flooding over and discovers the door is really small and there's only so many pieces of land for sale and there's only so much barrels of oil on the market and there's only so much gold that's available for sale and all of that. And so that's every great hyperinflation has just been that moment when people woke up and went, oh, I need to be over there, not here. Yeah. And so that's, you know, my greatest criticism of the central banks is that they've just absolutely pushed the markers of wealth into the stratosphere without any underlying appreciation that it's real wealth that we care about, not fantasy wealth.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Chris, we're out of time, unfortunately. I want to tell my listeners, though, that they must go to peakprosperity.com because you have a lot of ideas. You've talked about it over the years, how people can protect themselves. And it's not just buying gold, although that's one of the things that I think you very much gold and other tangible assets, but also other things you can do to try to prepare yourself for the times when things aren't going to be so good. We've had quite a party, quite an orgy in a way, I think, since we went off the gold standard. But, you know, it's coming home to roost, it seems to me, Chris, pretty soon. So
well, it does. And thanks for that, Jay. And yes, we talk about 8 forms of capital, financial capital, of course, important, but other ones really important to being resilient and weathering the storms that we think are coming.
Absolutely. So it's peakprosperity.com, folks. Go there. Be sure to take advantage of all that Chris has to offer. Chris and his partner, Adam Taggart, too, a very important part of this story. So thanks, Chris, for being with us. It's really a pleasure having you with us again. Even though what you're telling us we may not want to hear, we better prepare. And the only way to prepare is to know what is coming our way, to know the truth, and the truth will set you free, somebody said a long time ago. Thanks so much.
That's excellent. You're welcome.
All right, folks. Well, that is all the time we have this week. Next week, Brian Groves of Genesis Metals will be with us, Jeff Clark of GoldSilver.com, and hopefully Michael Oliver will be back as well to talk about his technical analysis of the markets. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.